Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Love is a leap of faith, and some people take a bigger jump than others. This week, Kira Sedgwick, star of TNT's The Closer and the new ABC show 10 Days in the Valley, reads Ellen Graff's essay, Our Joy Knows No Bounds or Lanes.
My Chinese friend Yuji invited herself over for a serious talk. Her English is poor, and she struggled to convey her message, but she was concerned. She had noticed I was lonely. Her brother in China, Zheng Hua, was lonely too. Maybe he and I would like each other. She offered to send me to China to find out. But if you don't like him, it's okay, she said. Her vocabulary exhausted, she drew a deep breath and said, Okay, all done. I was both stunned by her offer and strangely open to it. At 46, I had been burned to ash by divorce and had crawled back toward life, sometimes on hands and knees. The common wisdom is that people, in seeking love, risk losing themselves, but I did not fear this loss. And I thought that not choosing for myself might work better than choosing. I didn't wonder about what my perfect person would be like. I was way beyond that kind of amusement. Four months later, I found myself in the Beijing airport amid a surge of people, politely pushing, shuffling, and nudging past one another. This was unlike an American crowd, where you feel harried, even accosted. There, I sailed comfortably through a sea of humanity. I saw one solid figure standing absolutely still. He held red roses, and beads of moisture clung to his jaw. He wore an expression of contained expectancy. The temperature was 99 degrees. I immediately felt calm in his presence. Our courtship had already occurred in the form of our shared anticipation. Though we hadn't communicated, hadn't even exchanged pictures. But his being open to me, sight unseen, meant a lot. We had tried so hard in previous marriages, only to fail. So I traveled to him with an eager heart, and he welcomed me with the same. During our 3 weeks together, the absence of spoken words let things be themselves. I felt the air tingling and warm with a companionship sheltered from small talk. At our first dinner, he placed each delicacy on my plate and watched without making eye contact or smiling. He gave me just a little taste of locusts and sea slug, then nodded once, encouragingly, as if to say, try. He saw I loved shrimp and piled more onto the plate. Out of necessity, the first phrase I learned in Chinese was, I am full. When he asked, do you want to marry? I said, yes. I was surprised, actually, that he could say the words. He must have practiced and practiced. Later, we had a simple ceremony, and I returned to the United States to wait 18 months for him to be granted a visa. During this time, we communicated as best we could by phone in letters. His voice was balm to my nerves, and the monthly rice paper letters were always from, quote, the bottom of his heart. In return, translating with a dictionary, I sometimes wrote characters that had been out of popular use in China for centuries. When I asked about his father, it probably sounded something like, I prithee, how fareth the honorable ancestor? He had to devote many hours over several days to write one short letter in English. so I told him to write in Chinese and I would find someone to translate. In one letter, he wrote, "In my imagination, I see your slim figure buffeted by icy gusts of wind, and I want to cross the street and stand next to you. I long to shield you from the cold, but I am across the world, not across the street. We must both be patient. I will come and be with you forever." Finally, the day arrived when I was waiting at the Albany airport for him. It was winter. As soon as I took him into my house, he made himself at home. At the wood stove, he took off his business pants and stood there in his baggy, quilted long underwear. "Very comfortable," he said, one of the few phrases he knew at the time. After our meal, he rummaged in the bathroom until he found the mop, bucket, and Murphy oil soap. He proceeded to scrub all the floors in silence, upstairs and down. Then he went out on the snowy porch in his black business shoes and long underwear, looked up at the starry sky, and had a smoke. As is common in China, there were no random smiles, no effort at small talk, no hand squeezing or gentle pats. My husband would no sooner pat my hand or kiss my cheek than pat his own hand or kiss his own image in the mirror. I had to feel the air to know if everything was okay or not. I decided it was okay and went to bed, leaving him in the snow. When he came to bed, he held me as if I were something long lost and precious that might not live until morning. The first task was to find him work. A friend kindly hired Zheng Hua to help on a painting job. Great, I thought. But back home, he had been a businessman, and I didn't know that many post-Mao urban Chinese have complicated feelings of shame about performing paid manual labor. He gamely went along, but it was a disaster that ended with the friend pressing $200 into his hand and saying he didn't need a helper for the next day. I also didn't know that as a child, Zheng Hua had endured hard labor far more grueling than house painting. He had worked side by side with village farmers, standing bare-legged in icy water for hours, scooping out silt for fertilizer. His parents, ravaged by poverty and famine, often did little more for him than count his head as he safely returned at night. For his first 19 years, my husband endured such hardship and deprivation that by adulthood he had cultivated an internal equilibrium that was not easily upset. Soon another friend gave him a job at his natural food store. Zheng Hua had no driver's license, so the owner went miles out of his way to pick him up and take him home at night. But how long could that last? I needed to teach him how to drive. In China, he had driven a motorcycle, but not a car. How different could it be? First of all, the center line had no significance to him, and I had to instruct him that the car on the main road has the right of way and a red light means stop. Accelerating through an intersection, he said, "I don't think so." "Yes, that's the law. In China, who can go, just go. Big road, small road, left turn, right turn, this doesn't matter. Also, people drive any side of road." "What if another car is coming?" "No problem. Just not hit other car is okay." "Watch out, that guy is passing you on the right. You should be in the slow lane. Stay in your lane." I was gasping and holding onto the ceiling, my feet braced against the dash. He said, "I must ride in the back because I was making him nervous and this was, quote, very danger." He pulled over and I got out, took a few deep breaths and repositioned myself rigidly in the back seat, pressing my mouth shut except to yelp, "Stay in your lane! Do you know what a lane is?" I wasn't in the habit of drinking alcohol, but for several weeks upon each safe return, I sedated myself with Chinese wine. The kind that numbs your lips for a full hour. Barren winter trees allowed our elderly neighbors, Dave and Flippy, to keep a watchful eye on events at our place, and often Dave would telephone to offer assistance.
"Hey, I wasn't doing anything, and I wondered if you want me to bring my tractor up. I can pull that car out of the ditch easy. No sense in you two hurting yourselves."
One night, returning home through a blackness laden with spring snowflakes, my husband pulled up to the kitchen door to drop me off. I was so grateful. All that practice was finally paying off. He reappeared in the doorway minutes later.
"Sorry,"
he said, and started quaking in silent laughter, looking down and shaking his head.
"Sorry?" "Yes, very sorry. You see?"
He pulled me out to the garage. I looked in where the car should be, but nothing was there. Then I lifted my eyes and saw the taillights going west through a gaping hole in the garage. I ran around to the back and beheld the front of the car hanging in midair over the stone embankment. The AAA tow truck came and pulled the car back into the garage, no questions asked. We patched together the garage wall. The next time it happened, a week later, the same AAA driver arrived.
"I know what to do, ma'am."
During that first year, we used our full allotment of AAA service calls while Jung Hwa advanced from mistakenly pouring transmission fluid into the crankcase to being able to install alternators, timing belts, electrical components, and an automatic transmission. His method of repair generally requires 2 days of sitting in front of the problem, thinking and smoking old golds, before he touches anything. But his driving troubles persist. The police trail him. Other drivers shake fists at him. He can't remember the rule about not turning left from the right lane and recently put us in the path of a Lincoln zooming up fast. Tires screamed and Jung Hwa was looking into quivering jowls of the red-faced driver, who jabbed at him with a meaty forefinger, then stuck his face out the window and sputtered,
"You almost killed us!"
"Yes."
"I said you almost killed us, buddy! Do you hear?"
"Yes, yes."
"What do you have to say when I say you almost killed us?"
"Thank you very much."
"I'm yelling at you. Why do you say thank you?"
"I don't know. I just think, thank you."
"Okay. You're welcome," the guy said before warily proceeding.
Jung Hwa waved and thanked him again. And so it goes. Sometimes I remember our car grinding in slow motion off the gravel shoulder and totaling itself against a rotten tree stump. I see us climbing out of the wreckage, distraught but unhurt, and wonder if we were gently nudged off the road and saved from some other horrible highway fate by the gold Cupid pin my husband bought at a garage sale and wears on his jacket for good luck. Somebody must be looking out for us. A few years ago, my life was roadworthy, but lonely. It cried out for an intervention. Now every day feels like a wild car ride with Jung Hwa, lurching and unpredictable, but rich with humor, determination, and devotion. I don't question it. Like my husband, I just think, thank you.
Kira Sedgwick, reading Ellen Graff's essay, Our Joy Knows No Bounds or Lanes. It's been almost 10 years since Ellen wrote this essay. We'll catch up with her after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbons-Neff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ellen Graff says that learning to drive was the least of her worries when it came to the challenges she and Junghwa faced in their unusual marriage.
When my husband and I married, we were full of hope and probably both thought we knew ourselves. But I don't think either of us could have imagined all the obstacles and how different our cultures really are and what that means on a daily basis.
Before her husband came to the U.S., Ellen was an artist, a mask maker, and a sculptor. When Junghwa first arrived, he helped Ellen with her art, and they started a business together. But it didn't go according to plan.
You know, it was a hard scrabble life of an artist, which is our privilege to live, really. But then he became ill, and this wasn't very long after he came. And it turned out that he needed very massive surgery. It took him a very long time to recover from that. But he started to paint, and he did it day in and day out, and that kind of saved him.
Not long after her husband's illness, their house burned down. They lived in upstate New York, and Ellen had to take a new job as a mental health case manager to support them. Junghwa took any job he could find.
He worked lots of different jobs. He worked at a natural foods grocery store. We worked in people's gardens. But then we decided, you know, we really have to do something to get you a regular job. So he went to the community college, and he enrolled in an EMT training course. But the language just got him, and it was very discouraging for us.
Eventually, Junghwa and Ellen decided that he should focus on his art, though he still does odd jobs. Despite the challenges they've faced, Ellen says that her marriage has made her see her whole life differently. While she and her husband are from vastly different backgrounds, they have come to a shared understanding of what they both want from life.
The fact that Junghwa is an artist and I am an artist is probably why we've been able to make this work. Because you have to abandon what you think is correct, what you think makes sense, all the time. And by doing that, you somehow reach a much more basic common ground.
Writer and sculptor Ellen Graff. She's the author of The Natural Laws of Good Luck, a memoir of an unlikely marriage. Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says that the Times grappled with how to deal with Junghwa's broken English in the paper.
We had to figure out if the language, you know, written by her is mocking him or if it's endearing. And we had to come down on the side of it being endearing in this case, and that this contributed to sort of their, his learning of English, them learning about each other. It was true to who he was, and it revealed a personality of him being in this phase of learning so many new things in this sort of joyful way.
After the break, Dan talks about how the lack of a shared language can bring people closer.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Dan Jones says that this essay made him realize that a language barrier can sometimes lead to an unusual kind of freedom.
They're allowed to romanticize because they're not confined by knowing the same language. I just thought that was so refreshing, how that freed them from the protocol of typically how you get to know each other in a relationship. There was just so much that's refreshing about this piece and so many lessons about how to open yourself up to love and all of the joys and risks that come with that.
Thanks again to Kira Sedgwick. Kira says she chose Ellen's piece because she thought it was romantic in a very different way.
I just love the fact that she thought, well, maybe my Chinese friend, with whom I can't really have much of a conversation, knows better than I matters of the heart. The fact that she goes all the way to Beijing, completely out of her comfort zone, and that they both have that beautiful abandon and willingness to share each other's lives in these very bold and courageous ways.
Kira Sedgwick. You can see her in the new ABC show, 10 Days in the Valley, which premieres Sunday, October 1st. Next week, Peter Gallagher reads a story about the promises we make in marriage.
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and then again last summer. We're different people than we once were. Does that make breaking a promise easier? Last summer I said, "You can trust me. I'll always tell you the truth about what's happening." Today, I tell her small, comforting lies.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.